happiness and absolute peace. It is mixed with hardships. It is mixed with difficulties. So we are living in a material life and we have beloved ones around us. Any moment they are subject to get any hardship, any problem, any difficulty, any sickness. Mm-hmm. And without having that, I said, belief in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the nature of man, if we do not have a proper anthropology, if we see man limited to this material life, then it will be difficult. Mm-hmm. We remember that at the time of the COVID, lots of people, committed suicide.
Unfortunately.
While they were well off, they were very good. But the pressure was too much that they couldn't stand it. But we see that today in Gaza, we see people are having so much troubles and they are seeing their beloveds being killed. But why they can resist? Mm-hmm. Because they believe that there is something beyond this life. When I believe that Allah is just seeing it, Allah, my beloved ones are with Allah, then it gives me happiness. So, I mean, the way that you look at the life, so if those people who have materialistic approach to the life, this is a practical side of it. When you have materialistic approach to the life, then yes, the life will be difficult.
Okay.
Life will be full of difficulties because you want to have a happiness in the material life, that its nature is change, a constant change. The constant change means that you are going to lose what you have. Mm-hmm. Means that you are in constant despair and unhappiness and sadness and sorrow.
Yes.
What can remove this sorrow and sadness is to believe in a permanent source of power and happiness and wealth, and that is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You see that in Karbala, we have repeated a lot this dhikr.
Yes.
La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah al-aliyy al-azim, Abu Abdullah alayhi salam. Any hard condition, when Imam alayhi salam is, he recites this dhikr, la hawla wa la quwwata illa billah. There is no might and power other than the power of Allah. Means everything is under the control of my beloved. And when he is happy with this, I am happy with that.
Yes.
And this is to my goodness. Otherwise, he could stop this. And I am in a journey.
Yes.
We have a hadith in the book Al-Fiqh by Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam, page 393. Then Imam alayhi salam, according to this hadith, which is ascribed to Imam says, "Va'iza." Yes. فَزِئْتَ مِنْ سُلْطَانٍ أَوْ غَيْرِهِ. When you are afraid of something, when you are in a kind of a distress.
Yes.
فَقُلْ حَسْبِيَ اللَّهُ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا هُ. Allah is enough for me. Allah suffices me.
Mm-hmm.
The one that there is no beloved other than Him.
Yes.
عَلَيْهِ تَوَكَّلْتُ وَهُوَ رَبُّ الْعَرْشِ الْعَظِيمِ. I trust on Him and He is the Lord of the Arsh, the Great Arsh.
Mm-hmm.
أَمْتَنِئُ بِحَوْلِ اللَّهِ وَقُوَّتِهِ مِنْ حَوْلِهِمْ. I seek refuge from their power and might in the power and might of Allah. وَقُوَّتِ أَمْتَنِئُ بِرَبِّ الْفَلَقِ مِنْ شَرِّ مَا خَلَقَ. I seek refuge from the one who has created everything.
Yes.
وَأَقُولَ مَا شَاءَ اللَّهِ, whatever Allah wants. مَا شَاءَ اللَّهِ.
Yes.
Whatever Allah wants to happen, let it happen.
Mm-hmm.
Then, why should I be unhappy? Why should I be in distress? Allah wants this to happen. Then again, Imam says, لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله. There is no might and power other than Allah. وَإِذَا حَزَنَكَ أَمْرٌ فَقُلْ. When something makes you sad, say seven times, بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم. So you see that in two hadiths, the dhikr is revolving around the concept of la hawla wa la quwwata illa billah al-aliyy al-azim. Mm-hmm. There is no might and power other than the might and power of Allah.
IRIB English Radio presents questions and answers on Islamic beliefs. Answering your theological questions in questions and answers on Islamic beliefs. Send us your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
We worship Allah. So the point is that how much we believe in this.
Mm-hmm.
Do you really see yourself in the hands of Allah? If we have such state of mind, late Mirza Jawad Aghai Ansari,
Ansari
Hamedani, he was asked, what is tawakkul, what is trust in Allah? He said that if somebody puts a sword on your stomach and he wants to push it, stab it into your body, and you know that without the will and permission from Allah, this sword will not enter into your body. If you 100% sure at that moment, then you are mutawakkil. Means that this needs ma'rifah.
Yes.
And I know you may say, we may say that we do not have it. That is the problem.
Uh-huh.
Because we perform salat because of that. We recite Quran because of that. This is something that we have to achieve it. This is not impossible. Mm-hmm. This is something that unfortunately we didn't pay any attention to it.
At least we can change our look into the world around, because in so many of the looks of the people nowadays, people are self-centered. They are self-centered rather than God-centered. I mean, this muwahhid type of look into the world around, this monotheistic look into the world around can help us very much in order to have always God remembered and present in all our actions.
That is the hegemony of the Western culture. I mean, we are living with Western philosophy.
Uh-huh.
This is the fact, you know.
Especially the secular one, that's right.
Yeah, when I say Western, I'm saying
right.
the secular
that's
one,
right.
because even the West, in
yes.
West, we have lots of believers,
yes.
especially in America.
Yes.
Basically, Americans are very religious people,
yes.
and also in Europe. So when I'm saying Western, I'm not talking about the people. I'm talking about the hegemony of
yes.
the culture, which is that even those people are suffering from the hegemony of such corrupt, you know, materialistic with the philosophy that it's very hegemonious and it's very totalitarian.
Uh-huh.
It's very totalitarian in the sense that, you know, even ISIS was not like that.
Uh-huh.
Even, you know, when we want to talk about some extremist groups, we talk about ISIS. ISIS, they just pushed people to do whatever they want. Wear hijab the way that I want, perform salat the way that I want. But they couldn't do something with your heart. But in the totalitarian materialistic culture, they push people even to believe. They say you have to confess that you believe in what we are saying.
Uh-huh.
You have to believe that Israel exists.
Uh-huh.
And you know, in Germany, they issue a law that if you do not recognize Germany, then your nationality will be cancelled. So this is totalitarian.
That's right.
Means that they're very hegemonious. And it's not only about the politics. They bring whatever philosophy they have and they impose it on people's life. So the individualistic, the humanistic kind of philosophy, which is which entered in people's life
yes.
all around the world
yes.
because of the media. And people, they don't know anything about philosophy, but they are living with that philosophy.
I don't know. Have you ever seen recently, we can say, the advertisement, the commercials of the Zara, Z-A-R-A. They are mocking out the killing of the children of Gaza, making it into a fashion style all around the world. This is really a shame for the Western world, how to mock the killing of the children of Gaza and then give it, for example, with a shroud to the fashion models and then do commercials for the clothes they're selling all around the world. This is really crazy, you know? How self-centered can the people be in today's world?
This is what they do. This is what, now this is maybe surprising, astonishing for us. After 10 years, we might be used for that, to that. That is what they do.
Okay.
You know, if 20 years ago, if you wanted to tell people that come and wear some, you know, ripped clothes,
yes.
ripped jeans,
mm-hmm.
you know, people might say that you are crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But now you see that people are going paying for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is what they do with the minds of people. And this is how the power of media is.
That's right.
So, I mean, I don't know, do we have time or not?
We got about 2 minutes, or 3 minutes.
So in 2 minutes, just let me finish with this concept that said Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, لَقَدْ خَلَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ فِي كَبَدْ. This is the nature of this material life, that if you believe that we are here, you know, a few days ago, somebody called me, and he was a very religious person, and he said that, I feel that God doesn't like me. I said, why? He said, I have lots of problems in the life. I said, this means that you are a human. Mm-hmm. Allah says, لَقَدْ خَلَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ فِي كَبَدْ. Insan, human is in hardship. Mm-hmm. This is the nature of life. And this doesn't have anything with whether God loves you or not. Mm-hmm. But the point is that how much you love Allah. If you love Allah in a strong way, then you will find a way out of these hardships. Mm-hmm. And the hardships, these are in the nature of the life. And Allah has set up the life with these hardships because there are good fruits to come out of this. So if we want to get to the relief of mind, we have to study about the benefits of hardships. Hardships, one of the good things with them is that they help us to get rid of the attachments. Another point is that they show us the weak points. Mm-hmm. You know, when we are in a very easy condition, when you are in ease of life, we might think that we are good people, we are believers, we are nice, we are close to Allah. But the moment that the test is there, the moment that the hardships start, then we see that, no, I am not that much strong. That's I have lots of failures. Okay. So they show us the weak points. And if we want to ascend ourselves, then we can benefit from the hardships to get to that the perfection that we can achieve.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Agha Mohammadi, for a nice elaboration regarding this topic. It was very kind of you. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. The another episode. God bless you all. Fi amanallah. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban li Ali wa Husayn wa Hasan. لعلي وحسين وحسان إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسان لعلي وحسين وحسان كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
In a poignant display of solidarity, Christians residing in Pakistan have opted to hold traditional Christmas celebrations with simplicity due to Israel's ongoing onslaught in Gaza. Their decision is a symbolic gesture of empathy and concern for relentless challenges faced by the people of Gaza during this festive season.
The message of Jesus Christ was the message of peace and security. We need peace in Palestine. On this Christmas, our hearts are heavy and we feel compelled to express our brothers and sisters in Gaza.
Pastors from various Christian communities across Pakistan gathered in the capital city Islamabad on Sunday for a special joint prayer meeting to appeal for a ceasefire in Gaza.
In the spirit of Christmas, we gather here to raise our voices in prayer for the innocent lives affected by the conflict in Gaza. Our prayers are with the people of Palestine, and we stand united in our plea for a ceasefire and lasting peace.
Meanwhile, a diverse gathering of people also expressed solidarity with the oppressed people of Gaza through the display of vibrant balloons, each carefully adorned with messages of solidarity and support.
The situation of Gaza is extremely distressing. It is
genocide, it is violence, and it is extreme power play in a region that does not deserve this at all.
Ceasefire now!
Demanding an immediate ceasefire, the individuals of all ages called on the world to halt the ongoing genocide of Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip.
Christians in Pakistan are using this Christmas to advocate for peace in Gaza rather than engaging in traditional celebrations. The gesture underscores that humanity is not confined by religious or national boundaries, but it is all about showing compassion for the people in distress. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
For the 11th weekend in a row since the start of Israel's most brutal war on Gaza, rallies were held in Sydney and Melbourne in support of Palestinians. In Sydney, thousands of people gathered once again in Central Business District's Hyde Park for a rally dubbed Stop the Genocide in Gaza, called by the Palestine Action Group, an activist formation committed to supporting Palestine and opposing Israel apartheid. A number of other groups also joined the rally, calling on Western governments to finally put some pressure on Israel for its ongoing violence, genocide and oppression against Palestinians.
I think the Australian government continues to be a firm backer of Israel, to their great shame. So clearly, again, 11 weeks of massive protests, the likes of which we've never seen before, is having an impact, and they're feeling the pressure, so they're shifting their rhetoric a bit.
The rally, attended by school union representatives, was also joined by a group of outraged Sydney-based Jews who hold anti-Zionist views.
So-called posture of the Western countries and so-called international law is, in my opinion, just pointless, and it's appalling. But quite frankly, we've got a genocide happening right in front of us.
Some of the speakers acknowledged that Palestinians are experiencing the same struggle as the indigenous people in Australia. Many hundreds of thousands of Aboriginals have been killed or forcibly removed from their land and their families at the hands of colonial authorities over the past 200 years.
People at the Sydney rally praised South Africa for filing a case against Israel at the International Court of Justice, accusing Tel Aviv of committing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. More than 21,500 civilians have been killed by the Israeli army so far, including nearly 9,000 children and 6,500 women.
I mean, it is genocide. They should go to the International Criminal Court because they are committing war crimes. War crimes many, many times over. I mean, it's obvious, you know, this is the obvious to ordinary people that this is a massive ongoing war crime.
Also on Saturday, a rally in solidarity with the Gazans was held at Melbourne's State Library for the 11th week in a row. Max Civili, Sydney.
In response to the call of the Free Palestine Movement, massive crowds gathered in the Yarmouk refugee camp near Damascus to show their confidence in the strength and determination of the resistance in Gaza, confirming that the Al-Aqsa Flood operation is a fateful battle that ignited hope in their hearts, as it brings them closer to the defeat of the Israeli occupation and their return to their homeland.
We are here to support people in the Gaza Strip and voice our unconditional support to the resistance groups. After nearly 3 months of fighting, it's clear that the Zionist regime is facing defeat. The Al-Aqsa Flood operation revealed that Israel's collapse is imminent.
The Israeli occupation politically has nothing now, military has nothing now, security has nothing, economy has nothing, and we also tell the world that October 7th is the gate for the liberation of the whole Palestine, from the river to the sea.
Participants confirmed that the excess of resistance embraces the Palestinian struggle and supports all resistance factions, including the Al-Qassam Brigades and Al-Quds Brigades. They expressed their anger at the Israeli atrocities against the people of Gaza, emphasizing their adherence to the right of return and liberating Al-Quds.
Syrians and Palestinians have shown their absolute faith in the victory of the Resistance Front and Al-Aqsa Front operation, not only as a path to liberate the occupied lands, but also as inspiration for the generations to come. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Thousands took to the streets of Austria's capital Vienna to express solidarity with Gaza on Saturday. These demonstrations were special in the sense that they were the first street protests after a court ruling removing some restrictions on acts of solidarity with Palestine. Since October 7, police and government have been imposing strict sanctions on protests and even banned expressions of solidarity with Gaza entirely. Following a demonstration on November 5 in the city of Salzburg, charges were filed against participants who held signs showing Palestine in its pre-1947 borders. Police argued the banner constitute a criminal offense due to incitement to hatred for denying the Israeli regime's right to exist. The tide has now turned. The court dropped the charges a few days ago, arguing they violated freedom of expression. It ruled that it is lawful to carry signs showing maps of Palestine at demonstrations. The ruling comes only days after similar verdicts in Germany, where courts in Cologne and Munster ruled that the slogans "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," "Child murderer Israel," and "Stop the genocide in Gaza" can be freely expressed in the country. German police have previously used these slogans to prohibit protests for Gaza, creating worries that the free speech is under threat.
I'm here because I feel a duty to stand against the destruction of life, the environment, and dignity, because this destruction is being done in my name. And instead of making me safer, it's making it more dangerous for me to live in the diaspora.
While their governments stand staunchly on the side of the Zionist regime of Israel, thousands of people in Austria and Germany keep marching for Palestine. Experts say these demonstrations have placed some real pressure on European governments, pushing them to distance themselves from Israeli atrocities.
The court rulings are a welcome boost for the Palestine solidarity movement in Europe, where concerns are growing over a breakdown on Palestine supporters. Following recent court decisions, it is believed the coming year will see more and more demonstrations for Gaza. Dieter Reinisch, Vienna.
Iraq is marking the fourth anniversary of the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. During an event attended by high-ranking Iraqi and Iranian officials, the two commanders were prized as a role model for all generations.
Today we stand alongside our Iranian brothers to remember our leaders General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, whose memories are engraved in our minds. And although they are gone physically, their thoughts are still with us.
Former Iraqi Prime Minister Nour al-Maliki admired the two leaders and their role in the fight against terrorism in the region. The chief of Iraq Popular Mobilization Units, Faleh al-Fayyad, also addressed the ceremony. He said the role of General Qasem Soleimani and his companion was essential in standing against Daesh. Several Iraqi lawmakers were also present at the event. They said the two commanders' determination to fight against terrorists irritated their backers.
Today we remember the pure souls that fought against terror and defeated something that made terror supporters mad. That's why they committed such a cowardly act of killing our leaders in Iraq.
They expect that by assassinating our leaders, they will weaken our resistance, but they have failed to achieve their goals, and even after committing their cowardly act, it did nothing more than adding strength to us.
The attendees also condemned the latest attacks on anti-terror forces in Iraq and Syria, which led to the martyrdom of Sayyid Razi Mousawi. They demanded an immediate end to the U.S. military presence in Iraq. And they argued that this is the only solution to stop the continuous attacks on Iraqi forces and end violations against Iraq's sovereignty. They also expressed their solidarity with the Palestinians and condemned the Israeli war on Gaza.
A huge crowd have gathered today to commemorate the fourth anniversary of the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani and Al-Hajj Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The legacy of the anti-terror icons continue to live on, inspiring people in the region to stand up for the oppressed. Muslim Salim, Baghdad.
The journalists have found themselves stalked by the indiscriminate Israeli strikes, which so far have claimed the lives of over 100 journalists working for different media agencies across the globe. Journalists believe the regime is deliberately attacking them and that they are paying the price of covering the Israeli massacres and atrocities committed day and night in Gaza and putting on display the really brutal face of the Israeli occupation. This undoubtedly has limited the chance of the Israeli propaganda machine to whitewash the murder of Palestinian children and deceive people outside the occupied territories on what is really going on.
The Israeli occupation is still practicing this genocide against the Palestinian people generally and the journalists particularly. Till this moment, the Israeli army has deliberately killed 105 journalists who were doing their job of covering the Israeli crimes. And the reason behind that is to curb the coverage of Israeli crimes. In addition to that, it destroyed 96 media agencies in Gaza.
The sufferings of the Palestinian journalists in Gaza are not limited to the Israeli attacks. They are also grappling with the disastrous humanitarian conditions they are experiencing along with their families. Many of them lost their houses to constant Israeli bombardments and joined the displaced people in Gaza, who are estimated to comprise over 80% of the region's population. All they have now are small tents created of pieces of plastic, wood, and fabric, or at best, classes in the Nurba schools, which are supposed to be safe, but have been repeatedly targeted by Israel.
We, the Palestinian journalists, consider ourselves standing on the same front beside the resistance members on the battlefield. Our battle is to show the world the reality of Israeli massacres despite the ongoing crimes against journalists and the catastrophic humanitarian conditions in Gaza. As you see, I live here in this press van. It's really hard to fulfill your basic needs even when it comes to going to the bathroom. My family fled to the schools and they faced the same hardships.
Journalists in Gaza have to deal with many problems when trying to prepare a simple report on the situation in the Strip. Many cannot even find a chair or a desk, and hence they cannot perform journalistic tasks smoothly. Making matters worse, most of the time there is no internet in the Strip, and journalists cannot communicate with the world.
As a Palestinian journalist, similar to all my colleagues, we live in a very complicated situation. Even though we are chased by the Israeli strikes and killings, we find ourselves obliged to forget about the difficulties we face in every aspect of life due to this onslaught for the sake of reporting the truth. I assure you that every single one of the 2.3 million Palestinians here has his or her tragedy, and this includes us. Our daily life is horrific and unimaginable at all levels.
Like all the other Gazans, many Palestinian journalists in the besieged district have been killed brutally by the Israeli bombardments, and those who are still alive continue to suffer from the unlivable conditions in the region. Mutayab Msabih, the central area of Gaza Strip.
Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has slammed Israel's assassination of senior Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps advisor Sayed Radi Mousawi in Syria. Hezbollah called it a flagrant and brazen attack and a transgression of borders. Deputy head of Hezbollah's executive council told Press TV that General Qasem Soleimani had predicted that Sayed Razi would be assassinated in the battle to liberate al-Quds.
His martyrdom was only a matter of time. He was a man who had spent his youth on sacrifice. He was always ready to offer whatever assistance was needed to the resistance groups. This assassination will not stop the path which Sayed Radi al-Mousawi has opened for us. It will not stop us and other resistance groups in the region from continuing to walk in this path. We will remain on the battlefield to face this enemy which is occupying and looting our land. And with the blessing of the martyrs, the future will witness a new victory for the resistance in Gaza and the region.
Palestinian resistance factions Hamas and Islamic Jihad also said in a statement that the assassination of Brigadier General Radi Mousawi on Syrian territory is a crime and a cowardly act that threatens security and stability in the region. The Palestinian resistance groups lauded Sayed Radi for his role in supporting the resistance in Palestine.
We know that he was very close to General Qasem Soleimani and therefore worked closely with the Palestinian resistance groups and all resistance groups in the region. His efforts were based on the same school of thought as General Soleimani, and he walked in the same path, which they had opened together. Today, we can see the result of these efforts in Gaza and the West Bank.
The Iranian cultural advisor in Beirut said General Mousavi was considered as a man who devoted his life to the Palestinian cause and finally sacrificed it for the sake of Al-Quds.
Sayed Radi Mousavi, God bless his soul, was one of the great leaders in the IRGC who devoted his life to support the honorable resistance in the region, especially in Lebanon and Palestine. Therefore, he is a part of every blessed bullet or rocket that is being fired to target the criminal Zionist regime, whether in Palestine or Lebanon.
Sayed Radi is now seen as a regional leader and martyr, just as General Soleimani. He is regarded by many as a martyr in the long battle for the liberation of Al-Quds. On the martyrdom anniversary of General Qasem Soleimani, the resistance front has bid farewell to another leader. Sayed Radi Mousavi's role in supporting the resistance groups of Lebanon and Palestine was significant. However, for the resistance, martyrdom is another form of divine victory. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has vowed to take tough revenge on Israel for assassinating a senior Iranian military advisor in Syria. IRGC spokesman Ramazan Sharif made this statement during a press conference held in the Iranian capital, Tehran. He blasted the Monday Israeli missile attack on Damascus that targeted Brigadier General Sayed Razi Mousavi's residence in the Sayed Zainab neighborhood. He also described the assassination as a continuation of Israel's violation of international laws, calling on the international community to stop the crimes of the occupying regime, which endanger international peace and security. When asked about Tel Aviv's motive for committing this heinous crime, Sharif said the regime is seeking to expand its genocidal onslaught on Gaza to the entire West Asia region.
One of the reasons is that the Israeli regime wants to extend the scope of the war beyond the borders of Palestine, and they want to deflect public attention from the Gaza war. The second point, which is important, is that the Israelis try to show off their aerial dominance. Maybe these are the two main reasons because of which the assassination was committed.
The IRGC spokesman warned that Israel must wait for a direct or indirect response as Iran reserves the right to counter the Israeli assassination. He added, the martyrdom of the Iranian commander will usher in a new era where the Zionist regime will be the loser. Sharif also touched upon the U.S. support for Israel, saying Washington is violating international law by funding and backing the regime's crimes in Gaza.
Definitely, one of their strategies has been to change the Israel-Palestine conflict to Iran-America conflict. But as the wise leader of the Islamic Revolution said on the first day of the Al-Aqsa flood operation, this operation was launched by Palestinians against Israelis, and the U.S. support for Israel is the reason why the regime continues to exist.
Brigadier General Sayed Razi Mousavi was martyred by Israel while on an advisory mission in Syria.
Truth never dies, and today it's livelier than ever as the world is observing the Israeli crimes with open eyes, conscious minds, and bleeding hearts. No matter what the Israeli regime and its supporters do to divert the global community's attention from its aggression on Gaza, the whole world are unanimously calling for justice for Palestinians. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Non-binding UN votes will never stop the Gaza genocide. Only boycotts, banning weapon sales, and severing diplomatic ties will force the Zionist regime and the U.S. to heed the clamor for peace. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Middle East Eye wrote, as long as the world is faced with the U.S. tragic and debilitating abuse and non-recognition of institutions, the rest of the world depends on to enforce international law, economic and diplomatic actions by individual countries may have more impact than their collective actions through the U.N. and international courts. While about 24 countries have never recognized, the Zionist regime called Israel, Belize and Bolivia have also now severed ties with the fabricated regime of Israel over its assault on Gaza, while others, including Bahrain, Chad, Chile, Colombia, Honduras, Jordan, and South Africa, have withdrawn their ambassadors or diplomats. Other countries are trying to have it both ways, condemning the Zionist regime publicly but maintaining their economic interests. At the UN Security Council, Egypt explicitly accused Israel of genocide and the U.S. of obstructing a ceasefire. And yet Egypt's long-standing partnership with the Zionist regime in the blockade of Gaza and its continuing role even now in restricting the entry of humanitarian aid into Gaza through its own border crossing make it complicit in the genocide it condemns. If Egypt means that it said in the Security Council, it must open its border crossings to all the humanitarian aid that is needed, end its cooperation with the Zionist regime's blockade, and re-evaluate its obsequious and compromised relationships with the Zionist regime and the United States. Qatar, which has worked hard to negotiate ceasefires in Gaza, was eloquent in its denunciation of the Zionist regime's genocide in the Security Council, but Qatar was speaking on behalf of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, which includes Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and the UAE. Under the so-called Abraham Accords, the sheikhs of Bahrain and the UAE have turned their backs on Palestine to sign up to a toxic brew of self-serving commercial relations and $100 million arms deals with the Zionist regime, while Saudi Arabia was until recently preparing to follow in their footsteps. The UAE sponsored the December 8 resolution in the Security Council, where its representative declared, "The international system is teetering on the brink. 4. This war signals that might makes right, that compliance with international humanitarian law depends on the identity of the victim and the perpetrator." And yet neither the UAE nor Bahrain has renounced their Abraham deals with the Israeli regime, nor the roles in the U.S. might make right policies that have wreaked havoc in the West Asia region for decades. Over 1,000 U.S. Air Force personnel and dozens of U.S. warplanes are still based at Al Dhafra Air Base in Abu Dhabi, while Manama in Bahrain, which the U.S. Navy has used as a base since 1941, remains the headquarters of the U.S. 5th Fleet. The government that has followed through on its support for Palestine is the government of Yemen, which is enforcing a blockade of Bab al-Mandab Strait at the south end of the Red Sea against the Zionist regime's ships and ships bound to or from Israel. After it fired at, boarded or detained several ships, four of the five largest shipping firms in the world are rerouting their ships around the Horn of Africa to avoid mushrooming insurance premiums and dangers to their ships and crew. The reason the Zionist regime's die-hard supporters in the United States have tried to ban or even criminalize the campaign for boycott, divestment and sanctions, BDS, is precisely because boycotting, sanctioning and divesting from Israel may be an effective strategy to help bring down its genocidal, expansionist and unaccountable regime. U.S. alternate representative to the UN, Robert Wood, told the Security Council that there is a fundamental disconnect between the discussions that we have been having in this chamber and the realities on the ground in Gaza, implying that only Israeli and U.S. views of the conflict deserve to be taken seriously. But the real disconnect at the root of this crisis is the one between the isolated looking glass world of the U.S. and Israeli politics and the real world that is crying out for a ceasefire and justice for Palestinians. While the Zionist regime is killing and maiming thousands of innocent people with U.S. bombs and howitzer shells, the rest of the world is appalled by these crimes against humanity. The grassroots clamor to end the massacre keeps building, but global leaders must move beyond non-binding votes and toothless investigations to boycotting Israeli products, putting an embargo on weapon sales, breaking off diplomatic relations and other measures that will force the Zionist regime and American leaders to roll back the myths and lies they have conjured up to weaponize their people's fears and justify endless atrocities.
Start. Movement. Speed. Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. I am a Muslim. Islamidi. Islamidi. Allah my Lord. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم dear listeners from all around the world. This is IRIB English Radio and welcome back to your station. I am Beta and here
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. I'm حسنين. السلام عليكم sister.
السلام عليكم my brother. And we're going to talk about a new topic. Last year, I actually passed the university entrance examination and I went to university in another city far from my home here. Mm-hmm. And it was a complete new experience for me to be far from my family, live actually independently and so on. I was wondering, like, what was the impact of actually going out of my parental house and living on my own and so many other things that we're going to discuss in this episode. But before them, I want to ask you this question. When was the age that you moved out from your parental house?
I was 19 years old when I moved away from my home. And the reason I moved away was due to my studies.
Yeah. Mostly it is about his studies. So what do you think about the age that you moved out? Was it a good age to get far from your family and start an independent life?
It wasn't actually, you know, the independent, like really independent life.
Yeah.
You know, I moved away. But again, like, you know, I was kind of dependent upon my parents.
Yeah,
so, you know, I used to visit them every year. Like, it's not like, you know, I completely disassociated with my family.
Yeah.
For me, I guess it wasn't a bad age because I guess I was mature enough to, you know, like start my life independently.
Good. You know, I was actually working in this regard, and I was searching about the average age around the world that people move out from their home, and the age was 23 to 24. I was kind of shocked because I thought, like, in Western countries, specifically, people are independent from the age of 16, 17, or something like that. Mm-hmm. But the average told me that the age is 23 or 24.
Yeah. And so it's basically after, like, you know, they finish the studies, I guess. Yeah. It's for the work purposes.
They open the real world and they work and they have their job. And I think their real moving out is the time that you have financial independency.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because right now I moved out from my house. I live in a dormitory far from my family. But still, I have financial dependency. Yeah. I come here and I visit them. And, you know, these sort of things can actually help you not to feel the deep loneliness of completely disassociating from your family. What we have seen in, for example, Western countries and so on. So, for sure, there is an impact of this phenomenon that we see in Western countries.
What, you know, I guess there's a slight difference over here. Like, in this way that there comes in the Eastern culture and the Western culture.
Yeah.
In the Western culture, there comes a certain time that, you know, I mean, comparing it with the Eastern culture, in the Eastern culture, you know, children move away from their family or they move away from their homeland due to specific reasons. That might be for studies, that might be for, like, work purposes, like job or anything, etc. But in the Western culture, there's, like, you know, it's a norm over there. It's a norm that, you know, the children, like, when they're adults, or at least, like, you know, I guess maybe when they start working or when they're married, you know, they just say, you know, move away from their family. Maybe they live in the same city. They're not living with their parents anymore. Like, they're working, so they get their own house and they move away from their parents. But mostly in the Eastern culture, especially, it's to be seen that, you know, children prefer staying with their parents, like, unless there's a requirement. Like, they have to go abroad, like, they have to go to a foreign country to study.
Yeah.
So, and this moving away from, like, family or from homeland, it's got its own advantages and its disadvantages.
So, for sure, there is a difference between moving out of Eastern culture and the Western culture that you elaborated for us. After a short break, we're going to talk more about the advantages and disadvantages of moving out at young ages. So stay tuned, dear listeners.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back, IRIB English Radio, and you're listening to Youth Station. My brother and I were talking about the phenomenon of moving out from your parental house at young ages. And in this part of episode, we're going to talk about the advantages and disadvantages, both from your personal point of view. So what do you think? Was it more advantages or disadvantages for you, yourself?
So, yeah, the fact of it having, like, pros and cons.
Yeah.
So, one thing important over here is we carefully need to consider the consequences and weigh the benefits before making such a decision.
Yeah.
Like, which scale is heavier, like the advantages or the disadvantages. Talking about the disadvantages, like, the problem he faces is, you know, it might be related to the financial instability.
Yeah.
It might be regarding the financial problems. And it also might be, you know, someone as young as 16 or 17, or at least, like, even 20s, someone in their 20s, they might face the emotional challenges.
I get it.
You know, it's a new experience for him, right? You know, all the time he has been living with his family and suddenly he's away from his family. He doesn't have his mom to look upon him.
It depends on you, yourself, and your capacities, which are really important. I mean, it's not always about age. Like, for example, sometimes you are mature enough in the age of 17 or 18 to have this responsibility of working and making money.
Apart from the maturity itself, what I believe is, you know, when you're leaving your house, it's always, especially when you're going to a new place or new city or new country, there's always this thing that, you know, lack of experience in managing life independently.
Yeah.
Because it's a new experience, like, irrespective of the maturity. So the individual, like how much ever old he is or how much ever mature he is, irrespective of that, there's lack of experience, right?
Yeah.
So the initial stage, everyone faces problems.
For sure. I think it takes like 1 or 2 years at least to actually get used to the environment of living independently actually taking the responsibility of living independently. But the thing that I've talked about, maturity, I think is really important too, because there was a friend of mine who actually go abroad to study, but now she is unfortunately dealing with a drug addiction, dealing with some problems like that. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you know, because you weren't in the situation to face these kind of things, these kind of opportunities to go for drugs, to go to parties, to go whatever, and you feel like you're free. And this fake freedom that you feel when you go out of your house is something really dangerous and destructive, that I saw it with my own eyes, that it destroyed the life of my friend. And it's something so sad. And because of that, out of maturity, I mean that you have to have this maturity of handling the opportunities that you have access to something bad, but you control yourself, you control your nafs in order not to go for that, you know?
Yeah, that's actually like one of the concerning parts of leaving your home. As also we mentioned about maturity earlier, you know, I feel like, you don't, even the age, like critical, it's very critical, like what age you're leaving your home. When I left my house, I was living in the dormitory, I was living in a hostel. You know, there were children, like I was 19, I was almost like in my 90s, 19 and my 20s that time.
Yeah.
So there were also children like in their 15 and 16s, right? So, you know, after some years. And the other people that I've seen that, you know, he left his house in a very young age, like in while he was like 14 or 15, he was living in a hostel, like a boarding school or something like that. Why did I talk about maturity? Because, you know, when I left, you know, I felt like, you know, I'm kind of mature now, okay?
Yeah.
Like, I've seen pretty much of the world. Like, although I haven't seen anything, but, you know, comparing to the others. So I know, like, I was capable enough of making a decision, like, of in differentiating between right and wrong.
Yeah.
What's required and what's not? What is right and what is wrong? What do I need to stay away from and what can I go with? So, but the people who are not mature enough or are very young, you know, when they leave their home, so this, again, the thing you mentioned, this feeling of freedom.
Yeah.
Like no one's there to look on them. Like, you know, it was their mom, their dad controlling them. And now there's no one. They're free. So, you know, this is them and their surroundings, their friends, their mates, they're living with. So one common thing I've noticed in these type of guys is, you know, when they come, they are not mature enough. So their heart is still raw. Yeah. It's raw in such a way that they absorb like whatever they see in their surroundings. So this leads them on having a bad impact. So, you know, these type of people, you know, maybe in their behavior, I didn't find them to be very well. Although they might be, many people, you know, they're well, but they're good. But there are many people that I have seen examples, like, you know, who came out of their house in a very young age and they had society's bad impact on them.
Yeah.
So they're disrespectful and they're not good in their behavior.
So, as we talked up to here about the advantages and disadvantages of going out of the home, we came to this conclusion that there is pros and cons, and both of them may be at the same quantity. And at the end of the day, it's you who decide whether facing the obstacles of living independently and going through the right path without the supervision and controlling of your parents and you, or choosing that fake freedom and this actually deception of yourself that I'm free now, I can live on my own, I can have fun and enjoy and this sort of thing. So we're going to talk about it more after a short break.
If you have any suggestion, our email is englishradio@irib.ir.
Allahu Akbar.
So welcome back. This is your station, and we were talking about the advantages and disadvantages of moving out of your home.
Yeah. And we have discussed a few disadvantages and also a few solutions to that.
Yeah.
Now, I guess we should talk about the advantages of, you know, moving away.
You know, I think the biggest advantage that I myself had was the experience, the amount of experience I am mm-hmm. gaining every day living in dormitory, you know, facing so many new people, so many new societies, nations, and nationalities even. And this is something really rare that you, for example, live in a house full of, I don't know, for example, the number of my dormitory is about 1,000 people, mm-hmm. and 1,000 people from different nationalities, no, Arab people, lot, yeah. Indian people. And this is really interesting to live with this variety of people. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a rare experience that if I, for example, didn't go for another city to study, I couldn't have this chance to face these kind of different people and so many other experiences. And so the first advantage and the most important one, in my opinion, is experience.
You become responsible. You become responsible of things.
Yeah, nice thing.
Because when you're staying at home, you're like very irresponsible. There are people who are doing your work. Like there are people who are looking after you. When you're living away, when you're living in a dormitory, so you have to think about, okay, what am I going to eat for the dinner?
Yeah.
Like I have to wash my clothes. And like, you know, this thing, this makes you responsible.
Exactly. We talked about disadvantages, advantages, and so many other things about moving out of the home. But the thing is, it's all a test for you. You have to seize this opportunity to actually make yourself a better person, a more responsible one, a person that is reliable, that is strong, facing obstacles of the life.
Yeah, and in the end, we pray that all the people and all, especially the youth that are staying away from their home, may Allah help them in their lives and may Allah help in achieving their goals.
Exactly.
And one important thing, last thing before we end the episode, that, you know, whoever is staying away, just keep in your mind that it is really important that to maintain a connection with your family, like back home.
Exactly.
Yeah, every day you need to talk to your parents, like at least like every few days.
Yeah. So thank you, dear listeners, for listening to us. It was all the time we had. I wish you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum. Wassalamu alaikum. Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.